Our next speakers, we have Ramiro and Niels. And about 2 years ago at the CCC camp, Ramiro told us about how to hack microcontrollers cheaply with an Arduino and similar electronics. Now he and Niels are going to present the topic of Niels' master's thesis. They are both security analysts and they have turned their attention towards cars and towards all the little microcontrollers and all the electronics inside it. And they will show us why even a car that's where the code is coded to safety standards isn't necessarily secure. So please give a big warm welcome to Ramiro and Niels.
Thanks. Thanks everybody for being here. In the next 45 minutes, more or less, we'll talk about automotive microcontroller security. So first we will introduce a little bit what is fault injection. We will introduce what is the standards for automotive security. We'll explain a specific experiments we run on these microcontrollers and how we break, how can we break JITAG in these microcontrollers. And finally, we will do some recommendations about how to prevent these attacks. So first, let me introduce ourselves. I am Ramiro. I am security analyst, senior security analyst, and my colleague is Niels. Maybe Niels, you can move there so they can see you in the screen. We work at Riscure, which is a small hardware security lab. We are specialized in hardware. We sell tools for hacking hardware, and we also sell services, evaluations for embedded systems and chips. We have a lot of experience in many markets, smart cards, embedded systems, payment. And in the maybe last 2 years, we also focus on automotive. So when we came into this industry, or we started to work with this industry, we found the following. So this is what most of the people is doing, or other analysts or other hackers are working on. So they are working on the services online, or the connectivity between the car and the services, or the car gateway, the buses, the CAN buses. And at the lowest level, some of them are working at the ECU. So an ECU is the computer in the car. Maybe you know about these hacks, the Jeep hack. I guess that everybody knows this. Maybe you know about Tesla recently, also has been hacked a few times in the past. The Nissan, Mitsubishi, this was hacked with the application. So probably you know many more examples than this. I think that in the DEF CON the past week, they saw another attack on another car. So there are many of these. So a lot of people is working on these layers, especially in the communication between these layers. But we are focusing on what we are better in the lowest level of the hardware. So we are focusing on attacking the car from the microcontroller. This normally means side channel attacks and fault injection attacks, which I don't know if you are familiar with this. So in case you are not familiar, I will explain what is fault injection. So when you design an embedded system, you choose a chip, a microcontroller, and then you go to the dataset. And normally you find something like this, like you can operate this microcontroller between 1.88 volts and 5.5. If you operate at lower voltage or higher voltage, they tell you that it's not safe, but they don't tell you really what is going to happen. But we can imagine that if we run for a long time above 5.5 volts, which is the limit in this microcontroller, for example, or below 1.8, we can imagine, we can guess, that probably if we run above 5.5 volts, we will have fire. The chip is going to burn, probably. And if we run below 1.8, the chip is going not to work, it's just going to sleep, it's not powered. But the question is, what happened if we have something like this? So we operate the microcontroller or the chip for just few nanoseconds or microseconds above or under the range of recommended or the safe range of voltage. So when this happens, this is what we call a glitch. We have a glitch. Normally what happens is that because this signal, the glitch, the power peak is transferred or is distributed across the chip in a different way. Certain IPs or certain hardware blocks will be affected by the glitch and certain will not. So for example, we affect the CPU, and for a few clock cycles, the CPU will not work, but the rest of the chip will work. So it can be that the encryption module is still working all the way around. So when we do these glitches, normally we have these kind of effects. We can have bits that flips. So we have in the memory or in registers, we have zeros, and then they flip to ones, or we have ones, and they flip to zeros. We can prevent accesses to memories. So for example, the CPU tries to access to internal SRAM or to internal register, and then with a glitch, you prevent the access. You make the logic to access to the memory to fail, and then you return, you get zeros, or you don't write whatever you wanted to write in the memory. We can skip instructions. So we have a CPU, and it's running a set of instructions, and then we inject a glitch in just one specific point. That point, the instruction that is running that point, probably will not be executed, will be just a skip. We can sometimes we can disable modules. So we inject a glitch and a hardware module just will fail, JITAG, or will be, I don't know, encryption or whatever. And sometimes we have chip destruction. So we inject a glitch, we for few nanoseconds or microseconds we have excess of voltage. It happens that maybe an internal trace of the power within the chip will be fused, we will burn. So this can happen. So in order to understand better what is FI, full injection, I will let my colleague Niels to do a demo.
Pep, pep, pep. Okay, so now to show you that it actually works, I have a small setup to demonstrate what fault injection can do. And I have a camera here to show you what I have on the table. So what I'm attacking is this small Arduino Nano. It communicates over UART through these cables here. And the power comes through these two cables here. And if we follow the power, it goes through this amplifier, which increases the amps, because the tool that actually sends the power signal does not provide enough amps. And this power line will be glitched, like we saw in the few slides ago. Now we need to figure out when we have to do this glitch, and for this we monitor the UART communication coming out here, which goes into this GPIO pin, and it watches for a certain UART pattern. And when that pattern happens, this through this cable, a glitch, a trigger signal goes from one core to the other core. Because this little box here, Spider, is one of our in-house tools, and it contains two cores, Spider Core 1 and 2. Spider Core 2 can sniff data, and then using the GPIO pins here, we send a signal to the other Spider Core. On this Arduino, there's a small piece of code running from a hardware capture deflect that we were running last year called Riskier Hack Me. And this is one of the challenges from that capture deflect. So what it does is it prints an initial message that says level one, and then it goes into an infinite loop here, which will print lock all the time. And now you have to exit this loop in order to obtain the flag in this final lines of code. And this code is running right now on the target. which I will show you in this terminal. So you can see here the log message going on and on and on. And if I reset, I get this level one message and then chip status lock, 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 lock. And now the goal is to use fault injection on this loop here. And then we go out of this loop and we try to get the flag that's hidden here. So for this, I have a small Python script to control the spider. Here's some setup, blah, 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 blah. And this is where I program the trigger on UART on the pattern lock. And then here we wait for this trigger. And when we see the trigger, we do a glitch, which is the short drop in power that we called the glitch before. So this will run with, will run not. Okay, so now it tries various parameters for this glitch to try and find parameters for which the glitch causes a fault. And that fault should contain the flag message in its output. So here we see a bunch of attempts being made. And depending on how difficult your target is, this can take days or weeks or minutes. In this case, the target is not that complicated, so if we leave this running for about an hour, we will start seeing a bunch of successful glitches. For this demo, I have some parameters that will do that a little quicker that I already found, which I will run now. And now you can see in the output that we get this flag message that we were looking for. And that's fault injection.
Okay. One comment, we did the demo with our own hardware, but you can do the same with just very cheap hardware. You can just spend 20 euros and have a setup to do exactly the same. Actually, my colleagues here are going to think today or tomorrow to do some demonstrations how to use cheap hardware to do this kind of attacks. If you're interested, just come to our village, Rescue Fefe, and then we can show you. Okay, so, we see that in this case, we were dropping the voltage. It was dropping the voltage, right? We were dropping the voltage below the recommended, and we were having these glitches. We could also go higher, and probably we would get also glitches. But we can also do more things. So, for example, we can just try to play in this area, which is not recommended, so operate at higher speed this microcontroller, and with a voltage which is not in the safe area, and then we will have glitches. But basically, if we go to the dataset of the microcontroller and we find specifications that the dataset recommends you not to exceed, that's an interesting point to do a glitch. So for example, this is the dataset of this device. Oh, sorry. Sorry, back. Yes. Exceeding these specifications will produce a glitch. Always that you exceed it in a very short period of time. If we go through the dataset, for example, we find this specification for clock. And this is very interesting. Here they tell you that you cannot have between two periods, clock periods, you cannot have a difference bigger than 2% of the period. What happens if you seed it? They don't tell you. What will happen is that you have a glitch, a clock glitch. The same with the reset. They tell you in the data set that what is the voltage for the reset and what is the minimum pulse width of the reset. If you have a reset which is smaller than 2.5 microseconds, what happens? They will not tell you, but you will have a glitch. So we have different techniques to do glitching. We have voltage glitching, which is the one we saw here, by changing very quickly the power of the device. We have clock glitching, reset glitching, and then we have fancy ways of doing glitching, which is electromagnetic fault injection. We use a coil that generates an EM pulse to affect specific areas of the chip. So we want only to affect, for example, the crypto hardware. So then we put this coil on the surface of the chip, just wherever is the crypto hardware, and we inject a pulse, EM pulse. And then it will create a glitch in this IP, only the IP we are targeting. Or we can use lasers. We can decap the chip, remove the packets of the chip, and then we inject photons with a laser to affect gates. So we can literally chain bits using this technique. Then you can also play with the temperature, but the problem is that you cannot do it very quickly. You cannot, if the chip is operating at room temperature, you cannot set it very high very quickly and then drop it again. So we use this mostly for by raising the temperature, you can make the chip more sensitive to other glitches. So any of these previous techniques I mentioned it will have similar effects, all these effects. So you might think that this is not very common attack, or that this is not very useful, that right now there is not many examples on live, on the wheel, that will use these techniques, these hardware techniques. But the thing is that many industries have been dealing with this problem for many years, and maybe you're not even aware of that. So maybe you know this. The Xbox, the chip for the Xbox, was a reset glitch. You could hack the Xbox by putting a specific circuit which was glitching the reset line the reset line of the Xbox. The same with the Nintendo Wii. This one was doing a power glitch on the voltage of the CPU. This is a Wasabi chip, I think. And if we go back in the time, I think it's the first reference I heard of using a glitching for breaking a game station, a console. The old NES, there was a way to break the anti-copy protection in the cartridge, in the games, by using power glitch on a secure CPU or secure chip that they have. And maybe this is the ultimate AIDS test. Anybody? Anybody knows the relation between these two? Yeah. Okay, you are too old, yes. Okay, so I don't know, but I remember when I was a kid, you could go to one of these arcade machines and use the piezoelectric for a lighter, and this will generate a spark that will confuse the coin, the electronics that detect the coin, and will give you credits for free. So still this trick is working, so there is some people that is doing it. This is a video from YouTube. They are not using a lighter, they are using something more sophisticated. It's creating electromagnetic pulses. See the screen? Yeah. I wonder if you can overflow it. Okay, let's stop it. So, games industry have been dealing with this problem for many years, but probably the industry that have been dealing with this problem for longest is smart cards. So this, for example, is maybe you know, you heard about this. This is called Unlooper, this device at the right. It was used in the around the year 2000 to unprotect, to glitch smart cards and protect them so you could watch pay TV for free. So this was used 17 years ago. The good news is that we have some techniques to prevent this kind of attacks. We can use software and we can use hardware to prevent. So we can design, we can code the software in a way that is more secure against these kind of fall injecting attacks. Normally, these techniques are based on checking things twice. So for example, if you are checking a password, so you check first time, and then you check a second time. Maybe they inject a glitch in the first time you were checking the password, but then you have a second check that will detect if there is any error and will not allow you to access to the system. So there are different techniques for software techniques, and there is also a lot of techniques for hardware. So chip manufacturers can do something at hardware level to prevent glitches. Smart card manufacturers and secure SOCs, secure chips manufacturers, have been implementing these countermeasures for many years now. One of the most common, or the two most common countermeasures, are monitoring the signals, so detecting any glitch, any peak in the power or in the clock or in the reset, and adding redundancy. So those modules that are important or are critical for the security of the chip, they duplicate it and they run in parallel. So maybe a glitch will affect one of the modules, but not the other. So by running in parallel, you have more chances of detecting the glitch. So when we started to work or to research in the automotive market, we already have a lot of experience in other segments or other markets, and we tried to find or to assess what was the security level in automotive for against this kind of attacks, fault injection and side channel. Then the first thing we did is try to find standards against a standard that defines some kind of countermeasures or regulations against this kind of attacks. The problem is that there is no standards. The closest thing is the ISO 26262, which is not a security standard, it's a safety standard. So is this standard regulates what happens if there is a problem in your chip, in the chip that is in your car. So because the chips in the cars operate in a very noisy environment, there is a lot of noise because the engine, the engine, the sparks from the coils? I don't know the English word. The sparks for the engine. They introduce a lot of noise in the power of the ECUs, of the computers in the car. There is a lot of regulations to prevent the chips to crash. So in this standard, ISO 26262, they talk about fault injection, but as a technique to test if your chip is safe against this noise in normal operation of the engine or the car, the ECU. This standard defines the ACL, Automotive Safety Integrity Level. So this basically is a level which is given to devices based on the risk, the exposure to a risk, how is it to control the risk, and the severity of the risk, and then you will get a level which can be from A to D, being A, the chips or the systems that are less safe, and D, the more safe systems in an automotive or in a car. There is also a QM level, which is only given to devices that have no special mechanism to prevent against anything, basically. So QM is just normal chips. So we took a look at this ACLD safety mechanism that these automotive microcontrollers have, and then we found the following, that they implement these two mechanisms to prevent errors in the chip. So one is the CPU lockstep, so two CPUs run the same code at the same time, only that they are separated by a number of clock cycles. So if there is a problem, because, I don't know, gamma ray or because noise coming from the engine, whatever, maybe one CPU cannot execute properly the instruction, but the second CPU will. So the two CPUs are running in parallel, and they are comparing the output of the execution to see if there is the same. If it's not the same, there will be an interruption, and there will be some kind of routine that stops in a safe way the car or whatever. And we also found that there is a lot of redundancy in memories. So many memories are redundant. So this way, you can inject a glitch in one of the memories, flip one of the bits in the memory, but not the other. So these mechanisms are very similar to those that we found or we find in fall injection protected chips, so smart cars, for example. So we were wondering, we know ISO 26262 is about safety. Can be also used as a security, can be also protect this standard against fall injection techniques, because this is something that many people think. Many people think that the lockstep in the CPUs will prevent fall injection to succeed in these chips. So this is the research we did. Niels?
Yes, so this is where the experiments of my master thesis come in. So to investigate how effective these particular countermeasures are that we find in the automotive targeted microcontrollers, we took three chips. Two that fall on the ASLD spectrum and one that falls all the way on the other side on the QM spectrum. So these two, the red and the blue chip, will have these particular countermeasures, so lockstep and parity checks, to prevent faults. And they also use various degrees of architecture. So these two have, the bottom two have ARM, use the ARM architecture, and the blue one uses PowerPC, which are the two most common architectures found in the automotive world. Then we took two techniques from the techniques that were just listed. We took voltage glitching that I demonstrated, and we also had a look at electromagnetic glitching. And the nice thing about electromagnetic glitching is that you can localize your glitch more than with voltage. In voltage, you affect the entire power plane that you are glitching, while with EM, you can sort of target your glitch to a specific point on the chip. It's not as precise as a laser, of course, but it is still a nice upside. The downside here is that you also, in addition to finding when to glitch and how hard to glitch, you now also have to find where to glitch. So the initial thing we found in our experiments is that we could not successfully glitch the blue target with EM, with voltage. So this was only glitched with EM. And the other two targets, we could do both. Then we did two kinds of experiments. First, we did characterization experiments, which are very simple snippets of code that was also similar to the snippet of code that was running on the Arduino that we just glitched. And the purpose of this is to find out if you can successfully inject faults in your target at all. One of the nicest characterization experiments we did here is where you simulate the behavior that happens when some authentication happens, and the result of that is stored in a flag. And in this case, we just set it to one. And then if the flag is equal to zero, we are authenticated. And otherwise, we are not authenticated. And yeah, you see here that the branch that says not authenticated should happen, because flag is not zero. And what you can do with fault injection here, it's better to see if we switch to assembly to an assembly view of this code. So you will get a load flag instruction, then you will get a compare instruction. Then based on the compare, we will branch to a certain line in our instruction set. In this case, we will go to the not authenticated line and continue. So if we just change this one red bit from 1 to 0, all of a sudden our branch instruction changes to a store instruction, which if it does not corrupt our execution flow in such a way that the system outright crashes, will mean that effectively we have just erased this if check and we are now authenticated. So any fancy authentication crypto stuff, you can just bypass it afterwards. So we did these characterization experiments on the targets, and then what we have left with, we are left with finding is when exactly this if check happens and how hard we have to glitch to affect the amount of the bits that we want. So in order to do this, we first we look at what happens in normal behavior, and from that we determine windows where we expect that that glitches might be successful, and then we just start shooting that for a day or two, and we start plotting them in nice graphs to identify where sensitive areas are. So first you will see some green spots, which means nothing happened, and then you'll also see yellow spots, which means that the target either died or reset. So we are glitching too hard in the yellow case, but not hard enough in the green case. And then when, if you set up your experiment correctly, you also start seeing successful glitches, and that's indicated by this red dot in this particular plot. And then we have one additional category, which is this pink on the left, which means that the glitch was detected by the countermeasures present in the targets. And then when you run this overnight, you do 100, 200, 300,000 attempts, and then you start getting these nice graphs where you can see that if you are glitching hard enough, but not too hard, then if you go into that sweet spot, you will have successful glitches, which in this case are not detected, which was a surprising result. So in this particular case, about 25% of the attempts were detected. And if we look into the registers of the target, we see that over 90% of these detections originate from the lockstep mechanism, so where you have two cores doing the same thing. And then a smaller amount is because of the parity checks that are in place. Yeah, just to throw some numbers at you. If we find very specific fixed parameters for our ideal glitch, we are able to glitch the simple target all the time. We are successful with our more ASLD targets around 60% of the time. So for us, this confirmed that safety is not the same as security, at least according to this standard. No, just a single fault. The question was, do we need two glitches? And the answer is no, we only have one glitch to do this. Why? That's a good question.
We have some theories about that. We were expecting to have two glitches, to need two glitches for affecting both CPUs, but we found that one single glitch is enough. And then we have two theories. One is that we are affecting the flash. So the flash path.
We are basically glitching before we are going here. So here somewhere.
And the second theory is that because this is an ARM core, ARM R4, I think. It has 7 stages pipeline, I think it was 7 stages pipeline. Yeah. So maybe because the pipeline 7 stages needs, each instruction needs 7 clock cycles, the CPU lockstep is separated for two clock cycles, if we inject a glitch, we are actually affecting the same instruction but in different states. So maybe the first core we affect during the fetching, and the second core we affect during the execution. So it's still, we found this quite surprising, to be honest. We were expecting to have to need double glitch. Yeah.
Yeah, but we don't have detailed documentation and views into these targets, so it's very hard to determine exactly what happens. Okay, so now that we know that we can successfully inject faults at our targets, we wanted to do something more meaningful. And for this, we chose to attack the locking mechanisms in these targets that lock the JTAG down. And people, you want to lock your JTAG when you put your chips out in the field, so people can't just extract confidential firmware or valuable intellectual property. And from a more academic point of view, this is also interesting because before we knew what was running roughly, so we can make guesses about where we have to inject our fault. And all these locking mechanisms happen in hardware or in ROM code that we don't have access to. So now we are basically, we have no idea where we have to glitch. So we need to find other techniques to investigate where we need to do our fault injection. For this, we resorted to side channel analysis, because by looking at the power consumption of a target in a locked target and in an unlocked target, and then comparing the two power traces, we thought, well, maybe we'll see a difference, and that's likely where the JTAG is being locked, and if we do fault injection on that point, we will either keep the target in an unlocked state or unlock it. So, yes, what we do here, we take our power measurement, we see that we have power on, power off, but we still have no idea what's happening in the middle. And that's why we look at an unlocked and a locked version. So for the first target, we have, you see here a brown line and a blue line, and those lines represent the locked and the unlocked power trace. And when here we see a very clear difference at this point. So here we do fault injection, and we were able to keep the JTAG unlocked.
Sorry, just to clarify, what we did is just we run. So from the data set, we knew that somehow the JTAG lock is being set up during the boot process of the chip. So we run the chip, unlock it. So we have this chip, we both have development board, and then we program this board, one board with the JTAG lock and the other board without the JTAG lock. And then we were acquiring with a scope the boot up process, and we compare both boot up process. And we found a place where the power signal was different, and we were assuming that because the only thing that changed from one board to the other is the JTAG lock, we assume that this is the point where the JTAG is configured. So what happens if we glitch here?
Yes, thanks for clarifying that. We did the same on the other target, and we found a similar pattern that if we configure more or less configurations for JTAG, we see a clear difference in how much power is consumed at this point, and we do a fault injection here. And again, we were able to keep it open. The success rates are slightly lower than for the characterization. So if we start again with broad parameters, we narrow them down to what we find to be the optimal parameters. And in you see the percentages here. The simple target was very trivially unlockable. However, the ASLD targets were slightly harder. We need around 100 attempts to get one unlocked attempt. Also, before, we were able to completely bypass all the detection mechanisms. And in this case, we were not able to do this. Around 3% of the attempts were detected, which means that if these detections are handled in a smart way, you might brick a few devices before you are actually able to unlock one. However, when you see the difference between 1 and 3%, it means, yeah, you might kill 3 out of 100, but 1 in 100 will be successful. So if you just buy 10, you'll be fine. now my colleague will explain some of the consequences of what...
Okay, so we proved that using glitches in this ACLD automotive socks, microcontrollers, we can change the flow of the program. And with this technique, we were able to unlock the JITAG. So what are the consequences of this? So the most obvious one is that we can unlock the JITAG, we can steal the IP in the ECU, in the microcontroller. Let's imagine, for example, there is a lot of companies which is putting a lot of money in researching autopilot for cars, and a competitor can take this ECU that do the autopilot, break the JITAG and extract the IP, which will help them to develop their own autopilot for the car. So this is an example of what can happen. But if you dump the software, then you can also try to reverse this software, this binary, and use it to find vulnerabilities. These vulnerabilities can be remote. So if you dump, I don't know, the telemetrics, the telematic module, or the module in the car that connects to web services, you can dump the firmware, reverse, and then try to find a buffer overflow or something that you can exploit remotely. You can also try to find keys. So many of these ECUs have some keys, for example, for the remote to open the doors, or for the OTAs for updating the firmware of the car remotely. So there is some keys, so you can try to reverse them. So for example, we are interested in the UDS keys, which are the ones that are used to to update the firmware using the ODB2 port. The on-the-fly, on-the-air update keys, the remote, and the mobilizer, of course. So to prevent the car to be stolen, there are some keys. Maybe you remember this. Last year, Flavio did a demonstration in USENIX, I think it was, in USENIX. He was able to dump the firmware from a remote. From an ECU. The ECU in a Volkswagen car that controls the remote. He was able to dump the firmware, he reversed the firmware, and he found that in some cases the key is shared, and all the cars use the same key. In other cases, the key is derived in a very simple way. So he was able to unlock almost all the Volkswagen cars. So this is an example of what can happen with this. If you can unlock the JITAG and then extract the firmware, you can use it to find more exploits or more vulnerabilities. And maybe less obvious, something that you can do also if you open the JITAG is to modify the firmware. This can be useful for tuning. There is a lot of people that has been doing this for many years to add more power to the cars or to change different things in the cars. But this can also be used for sabotage. Let's imagine that, I don't know, somebody wants to kill a person. In the past, you cut the brake fluid cable. Now you can just break the JITAG, update a new firmware, and then make the car to collide or to crash when it's 120 kilometers per hour. So this is a possible scenario, and nobody will find any sabotage evidence because it's in the firmware. So what can we do? There is some things we can do. The first and most obvious is to add countermeasures. There is things you can do at hardware level and software level. So even in the system that are already deployed using the current chips, you can use software to minimize the risk or to mitigate a little bit the risk. But the most important thing is maybe that you don't have to reinvent the wheel. So there is already a lot of solutions out there. Smart cars manufacturers have been dealing with this problem for many years. So if you go to internet and you search, you Google, you will find a lot of papers talking about different countermeasures against fuel injection. So you don't need to do nothing fancy, you can just only see what is people doing already there. And a specific recommendation is that we found that many times we were trying to inject a glitch. the glitch was successful, meaning that we were able to bypass the security mechanism we were trying to bypass. But the chip detected that something was wrong. So there is some register that indicates if the chip detects some kind of glitch or something that is wrong. So it's very tempting, if it has programmer, to just ignore this. So make a software that there is that you, your chip says that there is something wrong, and you don't process this interruption to stop the chip. It's very tempting to do that. But if you do that, maybe somebody is trying to do fault injection and disabling one of the safety mechanisms. Yeah, now we are doing more research, continuing this topic. We are trying to find, of all the safety mechanisms in these chips, which ones are better to prevent glitches. And we are trying to apply these attacks on real ECUs and real cars. Because all this we were doing in a development board for these chips. So we were not really attacking a real ECU, we were just buying these development boards and then trying, because it was easy for us. So now we are trying with real ECUs, and finally we have a specific obsession, let's call it, with UDS, which is a protocol in the car. We are trying to break this protocol using fault injection. Thanks God, there is now some standards that they are being defined right now. The 3061, and 3101, these standards should address this problem. Actually, the 3061, the first part of this standard is already there. And they talk about side channel, they talk about fault injection, but they talk about this like very in a very superficial way. In theory, or I expect that when they elaborate the next parts of this standard, the part two, part three, they will talk with more detail about what do you have to protect for against fault injection and side channel. Actually, this standard define ACSIEL, so the ACSIEL levels, but for cybersecurity. And this 3101 should also address this problem, but this one is still working in, so we don't know what is in there. So maybe in the future, there will be some standards and some protecting against this fault injection techniques. Oh, no, sorry, this one. If you want to know more details about this research, we will publish a full paper in the FDTC 2017. This is next month in September. You will be able to download the paper with more details. I know that this fault injection side channel is very, I don't know, confusing or is very abstract. So if you are interested in knowing more details, tomorrow our colleagues will talk about how to use against fault injection to bypass secure boot. And I think it's a phone. I don't know what is the target tomorrow. And we have in our village, we have some demos and workshops about fault injection side channel. So you can come and visit us. At 5, we will have a demo on side channel, how to use open software tools for doing side channel, if you're interested in that. Sorry?
It's in our tent. It's called Rescue Fefe, and it's next to the Spanish hackerspace.
And where is the Spanish hackerspace? It's in the Hopper field. Yes, you can try to find us in the wiki. And, yeah. So, any question? I forgot something.
I forgot something, I guess.
Yeah, I forgot something. Sorry. Yeah, you forgot something, I would.
Yes. So I demonstrated this this fault injection on this small Arduino, which was part of a capture the flag challenge we were running last year, which is called the Riskier Hack Me. And we are now in our third edition, which goes live on Monday. So if you are interested in doing more hardware-oriented capture the flag style challenges, you should definitely register. And we also added some automotive components, and we are working with the company Argus Cybersecurity to make automotive-specific capture the flag challenges as well.
So if you are interested in hardware security, fault injection side channel, and automotive hacking, then you should sign up. For this, we will send you a board if you qualify by passing some challenges. We will send you a board with some challenges you have to hack. And that's it. Any question?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very interesting talk. just another thing that I need to try out the next weekend. So we now have about 12 minutes left for a Q&A session. Please line up on the microphones in the middle. And I see there's one question already.
Hey there, thanks for this great introduction to the topic and the demos. I have a question about the ASL standard. Why did you choose the colors? I wonder that you gave for the best class the red color. I would give the green one, but why give it the red one?
I don't know. I don't know. I guess that... do you have an excuse? I'm sorry.
The development board is red, so...
Yes.
Thank you.
Hi. How likely do you think it is that the development board doesn't have any protection against stopping this kind of injections? Because, you know, in the end, it's only that. Whereas when they actually deploy it, they will detect intrusions and say, okay, after three intrusions, you're done.
Yeah. We tested the safety mechanism or the security mechanism in the chip, within the chip. Because it's in the chip, this development board, have those. Of course, manufacturers can put more mechanisms, detecting mechanisms in the entire system, in the PCB. They can put more detecting mechanisms. But the thing is that you can always remove from the board the chip and test it in your development board. So you remove any of these mechanisms. In our experience, we normally have to modify a little bit these PCB boards because the capacitors in the VCC line, in the power line, filter the glitches. So we always have to do a small modifications in the boards. So we will have to do the same. We will have to do the same for this real ECUs. But I don't expect any kind of safety mechanism in the ECU hardware that we cannot bypass by just removing the chip and putting in a different development board.
Any more questions? Please line up. Yeah, one more.
Did you kill some of your devices while testing?
I think one died because of the EM, but that's it.
And we put one in acid to see the to see how it was inside. Yeah.
Yeah, that definitely didn't work anymore.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yes, please.
How much of a problem is it actually to access the memory via JTAG? Because usually, I think, in my experience, in larger boards, the memory is usually externally. So what can you actually do with a JTAG that you can't just do by desoldering the flash or whatever?
This is a microcontroller, not a microprocessor. So normally, when you have a microprocessor, the memory is outside. The microcontroller, normally the memory is inside. So of course, if this is a microprocessor, you can just tap directly the lines that go out of the chip, and then you don't need to do all this. You don't need to open the JTAG to get the firmware. But in this case, in microcontroller, the firmware is inside the chip. You need to open the JTAG in order to read it.
I believe that normally when they have external memory, they encrypt it. And
yes,
they only decrypt it once it's back into the controller.
Yeah, that's true. Some security features are quite common in some microcontrollers or microprocessors. Sorry, those that implement secure boot normally they have encrypted flash and sometimes encrypted DDR. That's absolutely true. And then in that case, you can also use the JTAG to open it and then get the decrypted firmware. Yeah.
One more question, or?
Okay, this is Wei. A lot of microcontrollers now come with encryption engines to make things possible quite quickly on the chip. Have you tried to focus attacks on that area of the die using EM or maybe laser or other techniques to see if you could do something with that?
Of course, this is actually part of our work. There is a specific technique called differential fault analysis where you use a glitch to affect the last stages of the crypto engine. And then by injecting different errors, you get different outputs, but with the same key. And then you can, by comparing them, you can extract the key without knowing which one is the key. So if you're interested in that, yes, maybe the guy in front of me can give you a lot of explanation about this.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
If there are no more questions, if there are more, please line up. I have one question.
Yeah.
So lots of microcontrollers, I think almost all of them, come with multiple supply pins. Have you tried how much different difference it makes if you just glitch one or a few of these supply pins to affect special areas of the chip?
That's correct. So sometimes these different pins are powering different internal power plants. So one is for the analog electronics, the other is for the maybe the CPU, a different one is for the CAN transceiver. So the first thing we have to figure out is which one is the one that the CPU is running from, and then we only inject the glitch in that. But many times in the documentation, you don't know, because the documentation only say VCC. So then we don't care, we just try all. So it will be less focalized or less specific glitch, because it might affect many things that we are not interested, but at some point, this is a game of statistic, let's say. We try 1 million times for fall injection attacks, and then maybe one will work. And because you have one single glitch will be enough to unlock the JTAG and extract the firmware. So,
cool. So, I see one more question.
When you do such an injection, how long does one injection take? Is it milliseconds, 1 second?
No, it depends from target to target. So normally it's often is related with the speed of the CPU. So if the speed is very fast and you do 1 microsecond, you are affecting many clock cycles, and then it will, probably you will kill the chip or crash the chip. So normally it's related with the CPU speed, but it's more in the range of nanoseconds, like 60 nanoseconds to, I think the longest I have seen is 1 microsecond or 1.5 microseconds.
Okay, I actually wonder how long you need to do the experiment, glitching it many times in a row before you actually have a success. Are we talking half a minute or a day? Or
The experiments that I showed you, these percentages, they are obtained after running a few days typically. So you turn it on before you go home. You leave it running over the night, you come back, you see your results, and then based on your results, you change your parameters and you iterate this process like 3 or 4 times, and then you're successful.
So you need 5 days to find the real parameters. So how much time do you need to glitch, where, and what is the voltage? And then when you repeat these parameters, you have a high successful rate. So then you can glitch it maybe in less than 1 minute. So you have to try less than 100 times, and then you will have a glitch. So less than 1 minute. Or 2 minutes.
Do I understand correctly that you reset the system between these attempts?
Yes, useful, because sometimes the glitch affects some modules that you are not aware of. So do you think that the CPU is working properly after glitch? But some hardware module has been affected, and then it's better to have a full reset before continuing glitching. But it depends. Sometimes we do, sometimes not, but useful, yeah.
For example, in this demo, it takes about 3 seconds to completely boot the device. So then I only reset when either I stop getting responses or I was successful. And every attempt, if nothing seems to happen, I just keep shooting and not resetting.
But next time, the next boot, everything might change quite a bit, right? I mean, the timing or different things happen?
It should not.
You have to find a trigger point which is close to where you actually want to do your fault injection. You can't just start counting from boot time, so yeah.
Before you said there was only one glitch and not two in those two processors.
The lockstep.
So how can you be sure of that? Or how can you count how many glitches there were?
No, we inject a glitch. With our tools, we say to our tools, inject a glitch. And we were expecting, because there is 2 CPUs, we were expecting to have to inject 2 glitches separated by 2 clock cycles. But we found out that 1 single glitch is enough. I don't know if this answered your question. Okay.
Okay, one more.
Could it be that you actually glitched the comparator?
Could be.
And that actually give you the result?
It could be, but I don't think so. The reason is because the comparison is combinational logic, so you can affect it, but immediately will get the previous value. It could be, but I think it's not very likely. But could be. We don't know, because we don't have the internal
I don't know, this, we don't know how it works internally, the chip.
If there are no more questions now, you have the village, you have to talk tomorrow.
Yes, maybe I can mention that if you want to see the demo more closely, you can also come down to the village and it will be running there.
Okay, and then please give one more thanks to this awesome talk and to our speakers.